45 years ago, Pennsylvania authorities came upon one of the most brutal, disturbing, and haunting crimes in the history of the state. Three suitcases thrown from an interstate bridge fell 300 feet towards the shore of the Lehigh River. Contained within them were the mutilated remains of an unknown woman and her unborn child. Now, thanks to genetic genealogy, investigators have managed to determine who she was in life. Evelyn Cologne, a 15-year-old young woman who vanished from Jersey City, New Jersey in December of 1976. Not only have they managed to identify Evelyn, but they've also arrested and charged the man they believe killed her and her unborn child that cold December day 45 years ago. Today, we will explore this massive update, as well as taking a look at updates and several other cases covered on Trace Evidence, those being the abduction and murder of Isabel Celis, the vanishing of Aisha Degree, the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie, the disappearance of Lashea Stein, the Littleton Bowling Alley triple homicide, the murder of Nick Kunzelman and Stephanie Hart Grizel, and the abduction and murder of Angela Hammond. This is Trace Evidence, Special Update Episode. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the breaking news regarding the identification of Evelyn Cologne, formerly known as the Carbon County Beth Doe, as well as updates in several other cases. Before getting into them, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Each week, we examine a different unsolved case here on Trace Evidence. In the past few weeks, we've gone into some truly horrifying crimes, and I thought maybe it would be nice to take a week to discuss not only the shocking news that the Carbon County Beth Doe has been identified, but also to see developments revolving around previously covered cases. Next week, we'll examine a new unsolved case, but for now, let's begin this Trace Evidence special update episode. Episode 81, Carbon County, Beth Doe. It was a cold afternoon with temperatures slowly dropping as chilling winds swept up from the south, growing stronger with each passing hour as the clouds rolled in. Thin strips of blue sky were slowly swallowed into the graying pall of winter as barren trees swayed with the whispering clatter of empty branches creaking. As afternoon began the transition to early evening, the sunlight grew thin, and within 30 minutes what shrinking light still lingered would be gone, the shadows of night stretching taller as the sun sank towards the horizon. The roaring buzz of cars and trucks racing home along Interstate 80 could be heard, echoing 300 feet below the bridge that spanned the Lehigh River. For 14-year-old Kenneth Jumper Jr., he was more than familiar with the sounds and sights down below, in the overgrowth along the shore. Living on nearby Tannery Road, Kenneth came down to the river nearly every day to check on traps he'd left out in hopes he'd captured wild game. On most days, the results were a letdown, though occasionally, Kenneth would be thrilled to discover one of his traps sealed shut and awaiting his finding. Stepping through the muddy sludge, mounting rocks for an easier course, the teenager caught sight of three objects in the distance, lying spread out beneath the shadow of the bridge. Oftentimes, passers-by would toss objects down into the wooded area below, and while most of the time this just resulted in trash scattering along the shore or falling into the river, today seemed different. A light coating of snow had dusted over the earth and trees, and near the objects, Kenneth could see their impact had carved small trails into the dirt. As Kenneth maneuvered towards the shapes, rectangular and solid, he noticed at least one appeared to have burst open upon impact, scattering its contents. He couldn't quite make out the shapes, though he thought one might be a ball as it appeared spherical in nature. While in most cases, the teen would be overwhelmed with excitement and wonder, hoping to discover some treasure, he couldn't help but feel a cold threat growing in his stomach, as if the pilot light of his curiosity had blown out. The shadow of something dangerous was looming, but not one to be dismissed by the tingling fear rippling up the back of his neck, Kenneth continued onward. What he saw that afternoon has stayed with him for the rest of his life. His memory is now inexorably tied to the gruesome scene. They were suitcases, three of them, with their handles severed and zippers painted in a flat black. The colors and patterns had been sprayed black as well, obscuring their design partially, but not entirely. They were smaller in size, two of them blue in color with red and white striping, while the third carried a plaid pattern. The two which remained sealed continued to harbor the secret of their contents, but the third which had ruptured upon impact revealed a truly grisly scene. The spherical shape that had captured Kenneth's attention was lying there on full display in the dying light. It was when he saw a pair of eyes staring back at him that the 14-year-old's breath caught in his chest. He didn't have time to scream, to stare, to be frozen in shock as instinct kicked in and his legs began moving on their own. He didn't even notice the sound blaring from between his lips until he was nearly back on Tannery Road. Within an hour, the shore of the Lehigh was crawling with investigators from local and state authorities who had never seen anything like this. Lit by blue and red strobes of police lights whirling in the night, trunks popped open and safety lights on metal stands were soon erected, this section of the shore glowing white amidst the darkness as traffic began dying down on the bridge above. There, investigators discovered an unidentified body, though due to the condition of the remains, they couldn't determine much at the scene. There was a torso, severed in two, wrapped in dirty old newspapers, the September 26th edition of the New York Daily News, and stuffed inside one of the cases. While authorities couldn't confirm gender right then and there, they believed the remains were likely those of a woman, as cuts to the torso suggested that her breasts had been removed. There were arms and legs, severed near where they would have met the torso, and a head, having been removed at the neck. The head, too, had been additionally dismembered, the ears and nose having been removed. There was, tragically, another discovery which confirmed the remains belonged to a woman. When the suitcase containing her head had ruptured upon falling 300 feet to the earth, the head had ended up near the case, but a few yards away lie a fetus near full term. In addition to the pieces of the body, one suitcase contained pieces of a chenille bedspread, a rusty reddish-orange color adorned by yellow and pink embroidered flowers. Beyond that, and the newspapers, there were also chunks of packing foam and straw. It appeared quite clear that whatever had happened to this woman had transpired at another location, and police theorized that her killer, upon dismembering her remains and stuffing them into the suitcases, had pulled to a stop along the bridge above and hurled them over the side. Whether that particular location had been selected in advance or was just along the route the killer was traveling was unknown. Police believed that, upon identifying the victim, it would only be a matter of time until they could find the killer. They had no idea that they were just beginning to pull the threads of a mystery which would endure for more than 40 years. An autopsy, conducted 3 days later, determined several details about the victim. She was indeed female, lighter skinned and likely between the ages of 15 and 25. While her remains had been horribly mutilated, they were preserved enough that fingerprints, believed to belong to the killer, were found and logged. Coroner Robert Dibert noted that while the dismemberment did not appear to be entirely haphazard or sloppy, It was also apparent that the killer was not a medical professional, but may have had some experience, perhaps as a hunter or having received minimal medical training. The cause of death was difficult to determine. There was a bullet wound to the back of the victim's neck, but as it turned out, she had been killed via strangulation. The reason for the gunshot was uncertain, maybe to ensure death or perhaps to throw off investigators. In regard to the child, the autopsy determined the fetus had gone to full term and had been removed from the victim's body at the time her torso was severed. The coroner's office also determined that the victim, now referred to as Beth Doe, had likely been subjected to sexual assault prior to her murder. And while the entire situation was gruesome and horrifying, they were able to find some slight comfort in confirming that she had been killed prior to being dismembered, rather than tortured while still alive. Beyond the manner of death and dismemberment, another clue emerged. On Beth's left palm, doctors located writing in black ink, which appeared to be the letters WSR, followed by two numbers, though they couldn't be sure which. The first digit, either a 4 or 5, the second, a 4 or a 7. What significance that writing held was uncertain, but it was believed Beth had written it herself, as the ink was determined to have been no older than 72 hours, while Beth had been killed somewhere in the previous 7 to 24 hours. Police managed to track the origin of the newspapers to northern New Jersey, though there was no missing person report that matched the description of the victim. In regard to the manner in which she had been killed and mutilated, many different theories about the killer emerged. The removal of her nose and ears was thought to have been done to make identification difficult, but the killer had left her hands behind, so that didn't make a lot of sense. It was also considered this was done to shame the victim somehow. The removal of her breasts was thought to be either connected to shame, some way of punishing the victim, or perhaps spoke broadly of the killer's misogynistic tendencies, the removal of these body parts suggesting a deep-seated anger and hatred of women. While authorities had hoped to find answers quickly, they discovered that the inability to identify the victim would hamper their hunt for her killer. It seemed unlikely the perpetrator could go on to live a normal life and instead would likely commit a similar crime at some point in time. So it became a matter of time. Perhaps they'd get a match on fingerprints and be able to solve the murder, as well as finding Beth's identity. Or maybe Beth's identity would eventually lead them to the killer. When discussing the case with the media, Pennsylvania State Trooper Frank Grippy was asked when they thought they might be able to provide some answers. He replied, quote, "Until we identify the body, it's pretty much going to remain a mystery," end quote. No one realized how true those words really were until now. Update. After 45 years, that mystery has finally been solved, and Carbon County Beth Doe has been positively identified as 15-year-old Evelyn Cologne of Jersey City, New Jersey. While in many Doe cases, discovering the victim's identity relaunches the investigation, the hunt for the killer, this time, it's different. Not only do police believe they know who her killer was, but they have arrested and charged 63-year-old Luis Sierra of Ozone Park, Queens, in New York. In 2020, cold case investigators sent a portion of Evelyn's femur bone to a private lab in Texas to begin the process of researching her identity through the use of genetic genealogy. This can be a fairly long process, and oftentimes doesn't result in a match right away. But in Evelyn's case, a match developed almost immediately. The mystery of Evelyn's disappearance had haunted her family for decades, though no one had any idea where she might have gone or what might have become of her. In hopes of locating her, family members scoured social media sites such as Facebook, trying to track her down. Miriam Cologne Veltman, one of Evelyn's nieces, spoke to CNN about the process, explaining, quote, "I was looking up these people on Facebook, and I went and messaged all these people. I feel like an idiot now doing that, and scared I could have tipped somebody off," end quote. It would ultimately come through Evelyn's nephew, Miriam's brother, Luis Cologne Jr., born 7 years after the murder, When his own hopes to find his aunt led him to submit his DNA to several different genealogy sites, Cologne Jr. told CNN, quote, "About 4 years ago, I heard about the DNA stuff, and I wanted to see. This would be an awesome tool if I could connect with family, and specifically connect with my cousin, because I knew she had a kid, or cousins, multiple children, or her. So I got the kits, purchased one for me, for my wife, ordered another one from another website because I felt the more sites I'm on, the more chance that something would come about from that." End quote. While his results showed distant relatives, he never could find his aunt or her child, but everything changed just last month, in March. According to Cologne Jr., he received a notification that his DNA had been matched to an unidentified victim in an unsolved homicide. When speaking to investigators, he was asked whether or not he was aware of anyone in his family who had gone missing, and in his own words, quote, "I immediately knew it was her," end quote. At that point, Cologne Jr. was told about Beth Doe, and he was able to receive composite images and several articles about the case. It didn't take long for family members to recognize the similarity between the composites and Evelyn, who no one had seen since December of 1976. Cologne Jr.'s father positively identified Beth Doe as his sister Evelyn by way of the images, as well as revealing details such as a mole on her cheek and a scar on her leg. When asked whether or not anyone knew who might be the father of Evelyn's unborn child, investigators learned the name Luis Sierra. They began trying to locate him, as well as questioning Evelyn's family to learn the circumstances of her disappearance. While details are still somewhat thin, what we do know about Evelyn tells the sad, tragic, and heartbreaking story of a young mother who vanished while her family searched for her. Evelyn Cologne was born on April 17, 1961, and would have turned 60 years old in just 2 weeks. She was one of five siblings of Puerto Rican heritage who were living in a home on 2nd Street in Jersey City, New Jersey. In 1976, when Evelyn was 15 years old, she became pregnant by her then-boyfriend, Luis Sierra, who was 19. At the time, Evelyn moved out of the family home and into an apartment with Sierra. As Miriam explained, quote, "Back then, things were a little different. It was a different culture, a different time in the 70s. You get your girlfriend pregnant, you move out, and that's how it is." End quote. At the time, the couple moved into the apartment, but Evelyn maintained contact with her family, who would stop by and visit, see how they were doing, and how the pregnancy was going along. According to court documents, several family members told current investigators that Evelyn was frightened of Sierra, who was described as jealous and controlling, to the point that he would lock her in their apartment when he went out, so she couldn't go anywhere. Additionally, in the documents, Evelyn also gave a warning. That statement reads, quote, "Evelyn had told their mother that she feared Sierra, and that if anything happened to her, he was likely involved." End quote. According to what details have been released, sometime in mid-December of 1976, when Evelyn was 8 or 9 months pregnant, she wasn't feeling well and reached out to her mother requesting that she make her some soup and bring it by. A few days later, when family members arrived with the soup, they found the apartment off Tennell Avenue abandoned. Luis Sr., Evelyn's brother, explained, quote, "I went inside and I saw the baby carriage. It was like one of those 1940s baby carriages with big black wheels in the kitchen, but nobody was there." End quote. Asking around to neighbors, family members were told that Evelyn and Sierra had moved out days earlier. They never saw Evelyn or Sierra again, and their last contact came in the form of a letter that arrived 1 month later. In January of 1977, Evelyn's family received a letter with no return address, though it was postage stamped in Connecticut. The letter, written in Spanish, stated that Evelyn had given birth to a 9-pound baby boy who had been named Luis Sierra Jr. The letter claimed that both mother and child were doing well and that, should Evelyn need anything, she would contact the family again. At the time, The family believed the letter had to have been written by Sierra, as reportedly, the letter had been written in a manner and style that they felt Evelyn couldn't have done herself. Whether this meant she spoke Spanish but couldn't write it fluently, or perhaps she had struggled with writing in general, remains unknown. But it was enough for them to believe that the hand at work was not Evelyn's. The family, unsure of what this all meant, lived under the partial assumption that Evelyn had chosen to separate from her family, starting a new life with Sierra. That feeling, though, grew weaker over the years, and family members continued to look for her around New Jersey. Unfortunately, no missing persons report was ever filed, and they had no way of knowing that, by the time they received the January letter, Evelyn and her unborn daughter had already been murdered, and she was now known as the Carbon County Beth Doe. For the next 45 years, there would be multiple attempts to try and identify Beth Doe through various methods. In 2007, DNA testing was conducted, and there was also radioisotope testing to try and determine where she had lived. Initial theories came out that she may have spent part of her youth in Europe, and there might have been connections to Tennessee, Texas, or Virginia. As it would turn out, none of those areas would hold the answers to Evelyn's identity. When the 2020 DNA results came back, they were uploaded to a public genealogy research site, and they immediately hit on Luis Colon Jr., Evelyn's nephew. After Evelyn was positively identified, police turned their attention to the last person known to have seen her alive, her boyfriend, and the father of her child, Luis Sierra. Research into Sierra's background is still in the early stages, at least in the public forum, so not a great amount of information is known yet. His name shows up in a few different articles related to a crime committed in New Jersey in 1975, though I can't yet 100% confirm that this is the same Luis Sierra, and until I can, I'd rather not make that connection. Instead, let's stick with what we do know. Investigators pulled Sierra's photograph from the Department of Motor Vehicles and showed it to Evelyn's relatives, who confirmed that while he appeared quite older, it was the same man. Police tracked him down to New York, where he was living in Ozone Park in Queens. On Wednesday, March 31st, Pennsylvania State Troopers Brian Knoll and Brian Janoski knocked on Sierra's door and sought to question him regarding Evelyn's disappearance and subsequent murder. Initially, Sierra denied knowing anyone named Evelyn and claimed that he'd never had a relationship with her. However, it became quite clear that investigators had a lot of information, and eventually, Sierra admitted not only to knowing Evelyn, but to living with her in Jersey City and fathering her unborn child. According to Sierra, they'd had a difficult relationship, and Evelyn had threatened to leave him several times in the last months of her life. He told the troopers that he and Evelyn got into an argument when he was leaving for work one morning, and by the time he returned, she was gone. He stated that it was his belief that she'd finally left him, as she'd threatened to do in the past, and gone back to live with her family. In response, he quickly moved out of the apartment and back into his father's home. When asked whether or not he tried to find Evelyn, Sierra claimed that he went by her family home several times, but no one answered the door when he knocked. His answers were contradictory at multiple points. First, he told troopers he thought maybe Evelyn and her family had moved away, and that's why he couldn't find them. However, he later acknowledged that he knew they hadn't moved away because he saw the family car in the driveway when he went by the house. When asked why he hadn't done more to track down his girlfriend and his child, he wasn't able to provide much of an answer, saying that he figured she wanted to get away from him, and so he let it go. Investigators found most of his statements difficult to accept, and when they turned their attention towards the letter sent to Evelyn's family in January of 77, they again found contradictions. Sierra told the troopers that, in December of 76, he and Evelyn had gone up to Connecticut searching for an apartment, and it was during this trip that the letter was mailed. In his description, the letter stated that they were planning to move to Connecticut, and everything was going well. The problem came up when investigators asked, since you didn't end up moving to Connecticut, why didn't Evelyn's family ever see her again after that trip when you returned to New Jersey? He didn't have any answer for that, nor could he explain why he'd mailed the letter saying they were moving to Connecticut prior to them actually finding a place, renting it, and, you know, moving. When asked about the part of the letter that announced the birth of their alleged son, keep in mind that Evelyn's child was a daughter, Sierra stated that, well, he would have named the child Luis Sierra Sr., though he could not recollect mentioning the baby in the Connecticut letter, nor could he explain the letter being postmarked weeks after Evelyn had been found murdered in Carbon County. Upon concluding their questioning, troopers read Sierra his Miranda rights and officially arrested him. At this time, he is being charged with one count of criminal homicide. At that point, he was taken into custody in New York, and as it currently stands, he's being held without bond and awaiting extradition to Pennsylvania. He was charged in New York District Court, and depending upon the investigation and the Carbon County District Attorney's Office in Pennsylvania, he may face additional charges. Sierra has made no public statements to the media, nor has his family, and at this point, there doesn't appear to be a lawyer yet hired to take on his defense. The Pennsylvania State Police have set up a hotline for anyone with information regarding Evelyn, Sierra, or details of the homicide to call in with what they know. Any information someone might be able to provide, be it in relation to any of the aforementioned details, would be incredibly helpful. Friends and neighbors of Sierra's were shocked by the arrest and his alleged connection to the crime. Several friends told reporters that he'd always been a good guy for as long as they'd known him, and they never saw this coming. One friend, who had known Sierra for 22 years, told the Daily News he couldn't believe it, and that he and his wife frequently had dinner with Sierra and his family. Several reports note that Sierra is married and has children. He's currently 63 years of age. More updates to come on this case as it's still unfolding. Both the Pennsylvania State Troopers and the Carbon County District Attorney's Office have stated they will release further information in the coming weeks. Evelyn's family were both excited and saddened by the news, never having believed something like this could happen to her. They'd always felt that she'd moved on with her life and made the choice not to be in contact with them, and didn't for a second consider that she could have been murdered, let alone going unidentified for 4.5 decades. When asked about Sierra, Colon Jr. told the Daily News, quote, "He lived his whole adult life thinking he got away with it. Little did he know that her future nephew, who never met her, would upload his DNA and that would lead to his arrest. The whole thing is just incredible. All the twists and turns. All of our family is distraught. It's been traumatizing," end quote. Miriam has set up a GoFundMe page as the family's hoping to raise the money to transfer Evelyn and her daughter's remains from their current location in Whitehaven, Pennsylvania, to be closer to family. They also seek to hold a memorial for her and see her given a tombstone with her true name. The family also announced that they had decided to posthumously name her daughter Emily Grace. A family statement is posted on the GoFundMe page and reads in part, quote, "After 45 years of desperate searching, our beloved Evelyn and her baby girl have been found through her nephew's DNA match. The hopes of one day reuniting with her were long etched in our hearts. She was taken from a family who loved her and a family longing to meet her and her child for the first time. We never could have imagined this would be the way we would see her again. The gruesome brutality of Evelyn and her baby's murder have deeply broken us. We are overwhelmed by the goodness in the hearts of so many people in the midst of this tragedy. We are touched by the outpouring of love and interest in our Evelyn and her family. She was a mommy's girl. She was our hazel green-eyed beauty. She was the young girl next door in downtown Jersey City, New Jersey. Her family loved her. Her family missed her. Her family never stopped looking for her. We are grief-stricken that our search has ended this way. In light of this Easter season, God has brought so many shrouded mysteries to light that have been entombed in darkness for 45 years. As Christ was resurrected from the grave, justice and identity for Beth Doe have been resurrected. She has a name. Her name is Evelyn Colon. Baby Jane Doe has a name. Her name is Emily Grace Colon," end quote. For now, that's where things stand. A true surprise to everyone who has been touched by Evelyn's story, now to see her name returned to her is a wonderful thing, but it does little to lessen the tragic loss of a 15-year-old mother-to-be. Over the next few months, many new details will be revealed. The case will likely move to trial, and through that, we might find out not only why Evelyn was killed, but why she was dismembered and thrown from a bridge in December of 1976. 45 years is a long time to wait for answers. I imagine we can wait a little longer to learn the full truth. If nothing else, this case is a solid reminder of why it's never too late to try and find the answers, and just how incredibly important genetic genealogy really is. If you would like to donate to Evelyn's family, you can find their GoFundMe page by searching for Evelyn Cologne GoFundMe or by visiting GoFundMe.com and entering her name. I'll also provide a link on the website and in the show description. Currently, they've received nearly half of the $15,000 goal, and I'll be making multiple donations through this month to try and assist in achieving that goal, including all proceeds made from Patreon this past month. My sincerest condolences to Evelyn's family, and my best wishes that they might find some comfort during this dark time through the support of so many who have sought to see her name returned and justice done over these past 45 years. If you have any information about Evelyn Cologne, Luis Sierra, or the crime itself, please call 1-800-PA-TIPS. That's 1-800-472-8477. No other cases today have major updates to the level that we've just discussed with Evelyn Cologne. However, there have been some updates that I wanted to go through in addition to this breaking news. So we'll begin with the subject of episode 20, the abduction and murder of Isabel Celis. 6-year-old Isabel Celis was abducted from her family home in Tucson, Arizona on the night of April 20th, 2012, 9 years ago this month. In March of 2017, Pima County investigators retrieved Isabel's remains from a rural area in the northwest of the county and confirmed her identity through DNA. 18 months later, on September 14, 2018, Tucson detectives arrested 36-year-old Christopher Clements. Clements was charged with 14 counts of sexual exploitation of a minor, 1 count of theft by controlling stolen property, 1 count of trafficking in stolen property, 2 counts of second-degree burglary, and 2 counts of kidnapping a minor under the age of 15. Clements was also charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in connection to the murder of Isabel Celis, as well as the June 2014 murder of 13-year-old Maribel Gonzalez. Update. Christopher Clements' lawyers have argued before the court that he should face 2 separate trials, one for Isabel and one for Maribel, rather than 1 trial which addresses both murders. It was put forth that by testifying about 1 murder, he might be forced to incriminate himself in regard to another. 4 months ago, in December of 2020, a judge agreed, and it's been ordered that each murder charge will receive its own trial. The latest developments come out just a few weeks ago, in March, when his first trial was scheduled to begin this month, in mid-April. Clements' lawyers have been working to suppress evidence in the case, specifically related to that which investigators were able to obtain from his cell phone. What evidence will or will not be allowed to be brought to trial has yet to be decided. Clements' lawyers are also seeking a change of venue, arguing that he can't receive a fair trial in Pima County due to the massive amount of publicity the case has received. According to the Arizona Superior Court calendar for Pima County, Clements will appear before Judge Deborah Bernini at 10:30 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, April 14th. Over the course of the next few months, we will learn more about the progress of the trial and what evidence is presented, as well as what defense Clements' attorney will provide for his client. The wheels of justice move slowly, and COVID has surely gummed up the works a bit, but it seems we're going to get some answers soon. Isabel, murdered at 6 years old, would have been turning 16 this year. Maribel, 13 at the time of her death, would have been turning 20. I will keep you updated on any and all new information that comes out during and after the trial. Our next bit of information comes out of episode 11, The Vanishing of Aisha Degree. One of the most haunting and confusing disappearances featured on Trace Evidence occurred during the early morning hours of February 14, 2000, when 9-year-old Aisha Degree went missing from Shelby, North Carolina. Early on in the investigation, two truck drivers reported seeing the 9-year-old that morning, walking by herself along Highway 18, north of Shelby. Over the years, there have been few clues and details revealed, with there being a potential connection to a dark green early 1970s model car thought to be a Lincoln Mark IV or Ford Thunderbird. Several items connected to Aisha have been found during the investigation. A pencil, marker, and hair bow were found near the entrance of a tool shed on Highway 18 near where she was last sighted just 3 days after her disappearance. In August of 2001, Aisha's backpack was found double-wrapped in plastic bags and buried off Highway 18, nearly 30 miles from where the child had last been seen. Over the past 21 years, searches for Aisha have failed to turn up any new information, and while her family holds out hope that someday she might be found alive, investigators tend to believe the child met with foul play. Update. The Shelby Star newspaper received a letter from Marcus Mellon in November of 2020 in which he alleged to have knowledge about Aisha's case. Mellon, who was convicted in 2014 of sex crimes against children, wrote in part, quote, "Aisha Degree has been missing for over 20 years. About 4 months ago, I had found out her whereabouts and what's happened to her. She was killed and then took and buried. I do know how and what town she is in. I hope you get this letter and come see me. It's on the up and up." End quote. While at the time, COVID restrictions delayed their response to speak to Mellon, Cleveland County Sheriff Alan Norman told the Star in February of this year that investigators did follow up on the letter and paid a visit to Mellon, as well as another unnamed inmate. According to Sheriff Norman, both men provided information in regard to Aisha, but that information came in second or third hand, with neither party having direct knowledge of what happened. According to Sheriff Norman, the information given was investigated and followed, but in the end, failed to lead to any new developments. Aisha Degree, who went missing 21 years ago, would be 30 years old if alive today. While the investigation appears to be stalled, it's never been inactive. Shelley Lynch, an FBI agent in Charlotte, told WBTV News, quote, "We are definitely still actively investigating the case. We continue to have regular meetings with investigators from the FBI, Cleveland County, and State Bureau of Investigation. We are actively investigating, following leads, generating new ones, conducting interviews, and utilizing new advancements in technology that didn't exist before." End quote. For Aisha's family, they continue to hope beyond hope that the answers will be found, and when they are, that their daughter will be alive. Aquila, Aisha's mother, when speaking to the media, explained, quote, "We've done everything in our power to find our child and bring her home. Even though she is 30 now, she is still our child, still the 9-year-old little girl that left. This is worse than death, because at least with death you have closure. You can go to a gravesite, or if you have the urn at home. But for us, we can't mourn. We can't give up. The only thing we got is hope." End quote. While this update failed to deliver anything new to the case, the hope remains that someone out there with knowledge of Aisha's disappearance will come forward to tell what they know. 21 years is far too long for a family to go not knowing what became of their daughter, sister, niece, and granddaughter. If you have any information about the disappearance of Aisha Degree, please contact the FBI Charlotte office at 704-672-6100. Before moving into the next updates, let's pause for a brief message from our sponsors. Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that keeps you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trace. Staying in the southeastern United States, we move now to episode 91, The Disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie. On the evening of September 23, 1992, 23-year-old Dale Dinwiddie attended a concert for the band U2 along with her friends. Following the show, Dale accompanied her friends to a local bar, Jungle Jim's, located in the Five Points area of Columbia, South Carolina. Dale's friends lost sight of her and assumed she'd gone home, though a bouncer at the club later told investigators that he had spoken with Dale between 1:15 and 1:30 a.m. that night and last saw her walking out of the club, heading north on Hardin Street. Her purse was left behind, and Dale has never been seen again. Update. In September of 2020, rumors began circulating that a woman who had been sexually assaulted told law enforcement officers that her attacker, an older male, made a statement to her that she reminded him of Dale Dinwiddie. At the time, investigators commented that they'd looked into the claim and found nothing to develop the investigation into Dale's disappearance any further. According to FITS News, a news website covering politics and current events in South Carolina, they were directly told by law enforcement that, while they believe the sexual assault accusation, they did not believe the tip in relation to Dale was credible. At the time, this story appeared in several newspapers, though none of them would name the man the victim had identified. All of that changed last month, though, when on March 18th, officers from the Richland County Sheriff's Department raided the Columbia home of Harry Gregory, a prominent South Carolina attorney and the former head of the South Carolina Accident Fund. Richland County Sheriff Leon Lott announced that Gregory has been charged with lewd acts upon a child, allegedly taking place between 2002 and 2004 when the victim was underage. While a search warrant was executed on Gregory's home, investigators directly stated that there was nothing about the search which was connected to the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie. However, that hasn't stopped locals from believing that there could be a connection to the man who lived in the area at the time and was known to frequent the Five Points area. Multiple sources, who chose to speak off the record, suggested that the raid and arrest almost undoubtedly had to do with more than the crimes for which Gregory has been charged. For their part, Investigators remain firm that there's no solid link between the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie and the arrest of Harry Gregory. When asked by TheState.com, a spokesman for the Richland County Sheriff's Department replied, quote, "There is no new information to provide on this missing person's case," end quote. So, whether or not there's any possible connection between Gregory and Dale's disappearance remains to be seen, despite the rumors swirling about in Columbia. Being that he was arrested just over 2 weeks ago, it will likely be a while until anything further develops. As always, I'll keep you posted with any new information revealed. If you have any information about the disappearance of Dale Dinwiddie, please contact the South Carolina Crime Stoppers at 1-888-CRIME-SC. That's 1-888-274-6372. The next three updates all come out of the state of Colorado. Episode 107, The Disappearance of LaShea Stein. During the early morning hours of Friday, July 15th, 2016, 16-year-old LaShea Stein snuck out of her family home in Aurora, Colorado. According to investigators, LaShea left home to meet with an unnamed individual without receiving her mother's permission, waiting until the family was asleep. LaShea has no history of running away, nor of getting into trouble, and had an important job interview the following day, which she was very much looking forward to, and she had recently been accepted to an internship at the University of Colorado, which would advance her dream of becoming a nurse. She left behind her clothing, wallet, money, phone charger, and other belongings. LaShea, at the time, was an honor student at George Washington High School. The last sighting of LaShea occurred when a surveillance camera captured the 16-year-old near the intersection of East Montview Boulevard and North Peoria Street in Northwest Aurora. In the footage, LaShea is seen wearing a gray jacket with sequins on it and a pair of capri pants. She stops at a street corner for a moment before moving to her right and walking on. Towards the final seconds of the footage, LaShea is seen crossing the street to her left. While the image is grainy and of low quality, headlights can be seen approaching at this time, and it's theorized that this may be the person who abducted LaShea. Investigators received tips from numerous people, though it appears none of them wished to give the alleged abductor's name. At least one person told LaShea's family that the abductor is constantly in the teen's custody and that he keeps her close to him, claiming that he rescued her from an abusive family member. The most which has ever been revealed publicly is that the man's name may begin with the letter D, or could possibly be Don or Doyle, though subsequent investigation failed to turn up any leads on those names. Update. On Tuesday, November 10th, 2020, the Aurora Police Department and FBI began searching a vacant home located in the 2200 block of Lansing Street, approximately half a mile west of the intersection where LaShea was last seen. The search, which lasted for 3 days, concluded on Thursday the 12th and came as the result of a tip authorities had received. According to Aurora Police Public Information Officer Matthew Longshore, the search was directly connected to the disappearance of LaShea Stein, and while they had no evidence she had ever been in the home, or more specifically the basement, he would say that LaShea knew the person who was living there in 2016. While the primary focus of the search was in the basement, the FBI also brought in cadaver and search dogs to conduct searches inside and outside of the home. According to Longshore, quote, "a few things," end quote, were located, which required them to call in additional equipment capable of breaking up chunks of concrete, which investigators would then have to sift through. Multiple news outlets reported investigators were seen entering the home carrying shovels. In speaking with the media, Longshore wouldn't get into much detail, but did note that they were hoping that people living in the area back in 2016 would reach out to them should they remember anything. Longshore explained, quote, "If anyone lived in this area and saw something in July of 2016 that maybe at the time they didn't think anything about, maybe it sparks their memory. That's the small information that we may need," End quote. What was discovered in the home, if anything, has yet to be revealed, as investigators noted it could take a while to sort through everything, and it would likely be a slow process. A statement issued by Lashaya's family read, in part, quote, "The Aurora Police Department has worked on this case since the day she went missing, and we thank them for following every lead. We believe that someone in the community has information about where she is. Please, if you know anything, come forward." End quote. A $15,000 reward remains in place for anyone who's able to provide information that can assist in solving this case. If you have any information about the disappearance of Lashaya Stein, please contact the Aurora Police Department's Crimes Against Children tip line at 303-739-6164. You can also contact Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Moving to Littleton, Colorado, we turn to episode 138, the Littleton Bowling Alley Triple Homicide. During the evening of Sunday, January 22, 2002, an unknown gunman entered the AMF Broadway bowling lanes in Littleton, Colorado at closing time. Present at the scene were the manager, 29-year-old James Springer Jr., 26-year-old mother of two Erin Gala, who worked the snack bar, and 23-year-old Bobby Zahas, a skilled bowler who was hanging out at the alley and was going to catch a ride home from Springer after closing. Around 11:50 p.m., a friend of Erin's arrived to give her a ride home, but she never came out. Instead, an unknown man exited the building, turned towards the friend and smiled before climbing into a truck and driving away. Several minutes later, the friend decided to go in and check what was taking Erin so long and discovered the grisly scene. All three were dead, having been shot during apparent robbery, as investigators would later discover the safe left open. As it turned out, there had been an attempted robbery just 6 days earlier, and it was believed the killer was likely the same perpetrator. The first robbery had failed when the suspect couldn't open the safe, so it was theorized he decided to force one of the employees to open it for him before opening fire and killing all three. Update. The Littleton Police Department, in conjunction with the FBI, Crime Stoppers, and the District Attorney's Office, held a press conference this year on February 17th to discuss the case as well as the discovery of new evidence and their belief that the case would be solved. During the press conference, it was noted that investigators were reviewing and retesting all evidence collected, including items discovered in the garbage of the men's bathroom, which had previously never been mentioned. Police Chief Doug Stevens mentioned this new evidence, as well as noting that some people had since come forward to provide new information. Interestingly, Stevens stated that there are likely still people in the area with information who have not come forward, saying they don't come forward, quote, "due to their close relationship with those who may have been involved, as well as their reputation and standing in the community and among friends. We recognize relationships change over time, as do people and their perspectives. It is not too late to come forward," end quote. Stevens also went on to suggest that there may have been people involved in the crime who were unaware of what was going to happen, saying, quote, "there are times when people are unknowingly brought into a situation by the person responsible. Rest assured, we have the ability to identify those who were inadvertently involved," end quote. During the press conference, it was also said that DNA was being utilized through genetic genealogy, and that advances in technology were being heavily utilized throughout the whole investigation. Several new details had already been passed on to federal investigators who were working to track down new leads. Mike Mills, who heads Metro Denver Crime Stoppers, addressed those who might have information that they haven't shared, saying, quote, "we'll get answers for James, Erin, Robert, and for their families and friends. There's no question in my mind that with your assistance, we will bring justice. Can you help? Will you help? Are you willing to break your silence, remain anonymous, and help us solve this case?" End quote. At that time, it was announced that a reward of $30,000 is now available for anyone who can provide information leading to an arrest. If you have information about the murders of James Springer Jr., Bobby Zeha, and Aaron Gala, please contact Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. In our final Colorado case, we revisit episode 99, the murder of Nick Kunzelman and Stephanie Hart Grizzell. In the late night hours of February 14th, 2000, an employee of a local Subway sandwich shop noticed the light still on in the main building, which should have closed down hours earlier. Upon entering, the employee made the horrifying discovery of both Nick, 15, and Stephanie, 16, lying behind the counter, having been shot by one or more intruders. Nick worked at the shop, and Stephanie had come to pick him up from work the night of the killing. What exactly transpired has never been determined, though it has been theorized that both were shot and killed during a robbery, that there may have been some connection to drugs, or perhaps that one or both victims had been specifically targeted. The couple, who had been close since middle school, were students at Columbine High School and had survived the horrible shooting there just a year earlier. Over the course of the past 21 years, there have been few developments in a case which many believe the community holds the answers to. Update. In hopes that money talks louder than the words of families ripped apart by violent crimes, the reward for information leading to an arrest has been dramatically increased. Jefferson County Sheriff Jeff Schrader announced in February of 2021 that the reward available for information was now at $100,000. Sheriff Schrader explained, quote, "With this significantly increased reward, people who haven't come forward with their information will be much more likely to do so now. We are continuing our diligent work to bring justice to Nicholas and Stephanie." End quote. Back in 2000, a description of a possible suspect was given out. The perpetrator was described as being a white male between the ages of 16 and 20, who today would be between 36 and 41. Standing 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighing approximately 150 to 170 pounds, the suspect may have had light hair at the time of the shooting. After 21 years, both Nick and Stephanie's family deserve answers, and to see the person who murdered their children pay for what they have done. Perhaps now, they have 100,000 reasons more to finally come forward and tell what they know. If you have any information about the murder of Nick Kunzelman and Stephanie Hart Grizzell, please contact Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. For the final update of this episode, we revisit episode 61, The Abduction of Angela Hammond. Perhaps one of the most well-known and disturbing unsolved abductions covered on this show and many others is that of Angela Hammond. Living in rural Clinton, Missouri, 20-year-old Angela Hammond was pregnant when she was abducted from a payphone on the night of April 4, 1991, some 30 years ago. Parking at the local Food Barn grocery store, Angela approached a set of payphones and rang her boyfriend, the father of her unborn child, Rob Schaefer. Rob was supposed to meet Angela later in the evening when he finished babysitting his brother, but Angela was calling to say she was tired and was just going to head home. During the course of their conversation, Angela seemed to become at first distracted and then concerned. As she explained to Rob, a suspicious man was circling the area in his truck. At one point, the man, who Angela described as filthy and bearded, parked near the phone booths and pulled out a flashlight, seemingly looking for something. He then approached the booth next to Angela, and she seemed to calm down, assuming he just needed to make a call. But moments later, she screamed, and the phone dropped. Rob, desperate to protect Angela, jumped into his car and sped towards the booths. On the way, he passed a late 1960s or early 1970s green Ford F-150 pickup truck with a rear window decal of a fish jumping out of the water. As he passed, Rob heard Angela scream his name and saw who he believed to be his girlfriend struggling with the driver as they sped away. Rob quickly changed course, unknowingly damaging his transmission in the process, and could only watch helplessly as the truck's taillights vanished with his own car breaking down on the side of the road. Despite exhaustive searches by police, which included tracking down every registered owner of a truck fitting that description, they were never able to locate Angela, nor positively identify her abductor. Over the course of the past 30 years, there's been many different theories and many different people looked at, though not a single person has ever been named as a suspect, nor has there seemingly been any advances on Angela's case or her possible whereabouts. Update. Just yesterday, on the 30th anniversary of Angela's disappearance, the Clinton Police Department issued an official update regarding the case and what they believe may have happened. Rather than summarizing the report, I will read it to you in its entirety. Quote, April 4th marks the 30th anniversary of the disappearance of Angela Hammond. Known as Angie to her friends and family, she was a recent graduate of Montrose High School and was well known and popular in the small community of Clinton, Missouri. Angie was abducted from a pay telephone booth at the corner of 2nd and Jefferson Streets. There has been no sign of her since. On this anniversary, we reiterate that Angela Hammond's family is still in our prayers. We refuse to classify this case as cold because we continue to search for investigative leads daily. A day barely escapes us without work or discussion on the case being held. Early in the investigation, a description of a suspect vehicle was developed based on the recollections of the person Angie was talking with on the phone at the time of being abducted. That was a late 1970s model Ford pickup truck with a fishing scene in the rear glass. Much of the early parts of the investigation centered around that vehicle description. Hundreds of leads involving vehicles matching that description were followed up on, but never produced any significant evidence. As the investigation progressed over the years, investigators decided to expand investigative possibilities that did not necessarily include the specific vehicle description. This opened new theories and produced legs of the investigation that had yet to be explored. As each of these leads were investigated, many were satisfactorily eliminated for one reason or another. A lead is never dismissed in whole or in part until there is enough evidence contrary. There are still several active and open leads being considered. One of those leads originates from the Lake of the Ozarks region. A confidential informant played a crucial role in disrupting a significant illegal narcotics operation by testifying in a court proceeding. When the informant's identity was disclosed during the case, he received a cryptic letter composed of cut-and-paste characters in the style of a ransom letter one might see in a movie about a kidnapping. The letter addresses the informant by the number that had been assigned to him to protect his identity before the court proceeding. It also mentions the informant's estranged wife by first name. The letter was postmarked April 4th, 1991. The exact date that Angela Hammond was abducted late that evening. The informant's wife and his daughter, also named Angela, were living in Clinton, Missouri at the time. After speaking with several people of interest and potential witnesses, the theory developed by investigators is that, in retribution for the informant providing information that led to the prosecution and disruption of this criminal enterprise, a person or persons involved in the criminal enterprise planned and executed the kidnapping of the informant's daughter. Some mistake was made as to the identity of the targeted Angie, who had some physical resemblance to Angela Hammond, resulting in Hammond's abduction. While the theory seems incredible, investigators have come across information that lends credibility to it and have so far been unable to refute it. This information is being publicly provided in part now with a plea. If you have heard a story like this one, or you have any information that could be related to this leg of the investigation, please get in contact with the Clinton police investigators. Very recently, a person left an anonymous telephone message for us regarding the Angela Hammond case. That person specifically mentioned two names. You did not provide us a means for us to recontact you. If that person is reading this message, please recontact us so that we might speak with you in real time. We will protect your identity and assure your anonymity. End quote. So it seems, after 30 years, the abduction of Angela Hammond may be a matter of mistaken identity and a crime perpetrated by members of a drug ring seeking to punish an anonymous informant related to the case. How that anonymous person's identity was discovered and how they made the mistake of targeting the wrong Angela remains to be seen. However, since information was delivered to authorities by an anonymous tipster, we can only hope that this individual reaches out again and gives investigators additional information to work with. If you have any information about the abduction of Angela Hammond, please contact the Clinton Police Department at 660-885-2679. You can also contact Crime Stoppers at 1-866-371-8477. Evelyn Cologne, Isabel Sellis, Aisha Degree, Dale Dinwiddie, Lashaya Stein, James Springer Jr., Bobby Zahas, Erin Gala, Nick Kunzelman, Stephanie Hart Grizel, and Angela Hammond. 8 cases in different places. While Evelyn's identity has been returned to her and her alleged killer arrested, the rest remain unsolved, although investigators continue to work leads and create new developments. All of these cases share one trait, one commonality. There is someone out there who holds the key to solving them. There's someone out there who could pick up a phone, send an email, leave an anonymous tip, and through that meager action, they could help investigators break the case open, bring closure to their families, and hopefully see the suspects arrested and charged. Maybe one of those people is listening right now. Maybe it's you. So many unsolved cases teetering on the edge of being broken. So many families just inches from learning the truth they've sought for so long. Evelyn Cologne has regained her name, and her daughter has been named Emily Grace. After 45 years, in a case where many believed it would never be solved, the wheels are moving, and each day presents a new revelation. This gives hope to all who wonder what became of a loved one, and still don't know what exactly happened or who was responsible. Perhaps, sooner than later, we can see more cases solved and more questions answered. Trace evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers: Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Vox Nihili. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode, and I hope you didn't mind this break from the norm. I just thought it would be good to take a week and focus on new developments, possibilities, and the hope that some of the cases we've discussed will eventually be solved. Next week, we'll move on to episode 155 and back to the normal episode format, and I hope you'll join me for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.